Today is Wednesday, December 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. More than 40 nations across the globe have banned travel from Britain.
We in the UK fully understand the anxieties of our friends about COVID, their anxieties about the new variant.
Plus, the dangers civilians are facing in Ethiopia's Tigray region.
These include artillery strikes on populated areas, the deliberate targeting of civilians, extrajudicial killings, and widespread looting.
And one family prepares to say goodbye to the life they know. We'll have these stories and more next. Over 40 countries have imposed travel bans on people arriving from Britain. This after the government announced last week it had detected a new, more contagious strain of the coronavirus. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the restrictions have caused major disruption as Britain struggles to contain its latest outbreak.
Cut off from much of Europe, chaos at major ports. Britain has been effectively quarantined by its neighbours. Dozens of countries elsewhere have banned travel to and from the country, including India, Canada and Russia. Britain's Prime Minister said Monday the government was trying to persuade European allies to end the blockade.
We in the UK fully understand the anxieties of our friends about COVID, their anxieties about the new variant. But it's also true that we believe the risks of transmission by a solitary driver sitting alone in the cab are really very low. And so we hope to make progress as fast as we possibly can.
The restrictions are being felt most acutely at Dover. Around 10,000 trucks use the rail and ferry crossing to the French port of Calais every day. Among those stranded is Polish trucker Stanislav Olbrich.
I have three children and wife, and they need me to come for Christmas. Christmas in Poland is a very special holiday. It's bind with religion and traditional. It's for Polish people, it's very hard to be away on Christmas. So this situation cost me very hard.
British exports are directly affected, while imports could be hit if European drivers refuse to travel. British supermarkets have warned of possible shortages. Britain announced late last week that it had identified a mutant strain of the coronavirus, which is 70% more transmissible. That prompted other countries to impose travel bans. The European Commission Tuesday recommended that all non-essential travel to and from Britain should be discouraged, but added that transport workers such as truck drivers should be exempt and that flight and rail bans should be lifted. EU member states are not obliged to follow the advice, and talks between Britain and other EU states are ongoing.
The current flight ban has been taken as a precaution. Other restrictions on other travel options from the United Kingdom are currently being considered.
Meanwhile, over 16 million people in southern Britain, including London, have been put in the highest lockdown tier, with household mixing and non-essential travel prohibited.
I think that the new strand of the virus is definitely concerning, and I think it is the right decision, but I just wish it would have been made a few days earlier.
Scientists say the new variant of the virus makes the rollout of vaccines even more critical. Over 500,000 Britons have now received their first dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. Meanwhile, it's just days before Britain is due to leave the Brexit transition period on January 1st, with no trade deal yet agreed. Deal or no deal, Britain's EU exit is predicted to cause further trade and travel disruption. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
France said it will reopen its borders to passengers from Britain Wednesday. The move ends a blockade intended to stop the spread of the new coronavirus variant, but which has held up thousands of trucks before the Christmas holiday. U.S. officials are also considering a requirement for all travelers from Britain to offer proof that they have tested negative for COVID-19. The United States has not restricted flights from Britain. However, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said that he has asked airlines flying into the state from Britain to make all passengers take a COVID-19 test before they get on the plane. Three airlines, Virgin Atlantic, British Airways, and Delta Airlines, have agreed to Governor Cuomo's request. Elsewhere, scientists say a second, more serious wave of COVID-19 in South Africa is being driven in part by a new variant of the virus. Infections and deaths are spiking in the country that so far has been the worst affected by the pandemic in Africa. There have been more than 920,000 cases of the coronavirus, with almost 25,000 deaths in South Africa. Darren Taylor has that part of the story.
South African genomic scientists are calling the new COVID-19 variant 501.V2. They've been analyzing coronavirus genetic samples from different parts of the country since the start of the pandemic. In the past few weeks, the samples have been dominated by a new lineage, as the scientists call it. South African Medical Association chairperson Dr. Angelique Kutsia says she expected South Africa's second wave of COVID-19 to be much like its first, but it's not.
We, as doctors, has already noticed that the last 2 weeks, the presentation of patients to the surgeries and in hospitals are different. And we were wondering about this, as it is not what we expected.
She says the surge of cases is putting immense pressure on hospitals around the country.
It seems as if your antibodies have difficulties in curbing this new different type. And this is like the black sheep of the family. You know the others, you know how they behave. You can fairly say, okay, this will do the following. But this black sheep, he's got different clothes that he's wearing. So he puts
Kutsia says doctors have noticed one major difference with regard to COVID-501.V2.
Where in the past, the younger people was not really that sick. We are now seeing that people, especially overweight people, round about the age between 20 and 30, are also now in ICU with severe inflammation from this virus.
The chair of South Africa's COVID-19 Advisory Committee, Professor Salim Abdul Karim, says the variation makes the virus slightly more transmissible.
We have always been seeing these lineages, and we know we've had quite a large diversity. And three or four of these lineages account for about a third to around 40% of all our viruses in South Africa. So we've used to the idea of high variability and different viruses spreading at the same time.
Professor Richard Lessels of the KwaZulu-Natal Research Innovation and Sequencing Platform in Durban is one of the scientists who identified the new variation.
It's highly unlikely that it would have any different clinical symptoms. There's no reason to believe that, and that wouldn't fit with our understanding. But one of our concerns is, could there be a difference in the progression of the disease, the more aggressive disease course?
Karim shares this concern.
It's still very early, but at this stage, the preliminary data suggest that the virus that's now dominating in the second wave is spreading faster than the first wave. It's not clear if the second wave has more or less deaths. In other words, the severity is still unclear.
Lessel says that lack of clarity is likely to persist for a while.
As we go into the second wave and we see this rapid rise in cases, clinicians are again faced with seeing a lot of patients in the hospitals and a lot of patients who are very sick. And so getting a sense of whether they're seeing a different disease course is challenging, and it needs us to look at the data very carefully and tease out some of the...
At the same time, a new variant of the virus is spreading in South Africa. A different COVID-19 mutation is circulating in Britain. That variant appears to spread more easily than other versions, although it's not yet clear if that makes it more dangerous to those it infects. The new turn in the pandemic in South Africa is causing anxiety that the vaccines to be rolled out in the country in the near future won't be effective against COVID variant 501.V2. Scientists are convinced they'll work, but can't say for sure yet. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
South Korea on Tuesday moved to shut down all ski resorts and winter tourist spots in a bid to stop the novel coronavirus from spreading. This, as a third wave of the pandemic proves much tougher to contain in the densely populated region of the capital city. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson takes it from here.
South Korea is battling a new outbreak of coronavirus infections, putting its no-lockdown strategy to the test. The surge has rattled the country that for much of 2020 was held up as a COVID-19 success story.
My name is Wu.
On Tuesday, it moved to shut down all ski resorts and winter tourist spots from this Thursday until early January. There's also a ban on gatherings of more than four people in Seoul and its surrounding areas, though funerals and weddings are exempt. Disinfection officer Yoon Tae-ho said people should heed the rules across the whole country.
We also strongly recommend that people should refrain from having a social gathering of five or more people nationwide. Considering infection cases among family members and friends, restaurants need to ban a reservation and an entry for five or more people. If they breach these measures, they will be fined.
The national government has so far resisted calls to impose phase three in the country's anti-COVID-19 plans. That would mean the toughest category of social distancing rules, essentially locking down Asia's fourth largest economy. South Korea announced its highest number of daily deaths on Monday with 24 fatalities, and there were a record number of new cases on Sunday. This third wave of the virus has been particularly hard for contact tracers to get on top of as it emerged in the densely populated capital region.
That was Reuters reporter Flora Bradley Watson. Russia's foreign ministry has announced Moscow is expanding the list of European officials barred from entering Russia. The move comes in response to the European Union's sanctions over the poisoning of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. AP correspondent Zaria Shakily reports.
The move comes a day after Navalny, a longtime adversary of President Vladimir Putin, released a recording of a phone call he said he made to an alleged state security operative who was identified by media as a member of a team that has reportedly trailed the politician for years. In the recording, the man indicated his involvement in covering up the supposed poisoning and revealed some details of the alleged operation. The EU has imposed sanctions on six Russian officials. I'm Zaria Shakily.
And coming up later...
The Saudis want to get out, but they don't know how. Because resolving the Yemeni question has also to do with ending Iranian military assistance that allow Yemen to launch attacks against oil installations in Saudi Arabia.
This is VOA News.
AP Showbiz Minute. Country singer Katie Oslin, who hit it big with the 1987 hit 80s Ladies and won three Grammy Awards, has died. She was 78. She died in suburban Nashville, Tennessee on Monday morning. Oslin had been suffering from Parkinson's disease and had lived in an assisted living facility since 2016. She tested positive for COVID-19 last week. Warner Bros. Says the superhero sequel Wonder Woman 1984 has earned an estimated $38.5 million in ticket sales from international theaters. The film started its rollout abroad last week and admissions totaled over 6 million. Most of the earnings came from Chinese theaters. Wonder Woman 1984 won't open in US theaters until Christmas Day, when it will also debut on HBO Max. A few days before Christmas, on the outskirts of the Peruvian capital Lima, a plastic bubble is helping keep Santa Claus and visiting children safe from COVID-19. The barrier allows the youngsters to approach Santa with confidence. This is Lizzie Knight with AP Showbiz Minute.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is warning that civilians in Ethiopia's Tigray region are in extreme peril amid allegations of widespread violations, some possibly amounting to war crimes. Lisa Schlein has more.
It is difficult to verify many of these allegations and to gauge the extent of human suffering in Tigray because of the ongoing communications blackout in many areas. Human Rights Chief Bachelet is calling for unhindered access to the region by independent human rights monitors to assess conditions, protect civilians, and bring perpetrators of crimes to justice. The High Commissioner spokeswoman Liz Throssell says the Human Rights Office has received consistent information pointing to violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law by all parties to the conflict.
These include artillery strikes on populated areas, the deliberate targeting of civilians, extrajudicial killings, and widespread looting. Among the accounts, witnesses described artillery strikes on the town of Humaira on the border with Eritrea between the 9th and the 11th of November. We interviewed several people from the town who alleged that shells launched from Eritrea had hit residential areas and the hospital.
Throssell says the Ethiopian army and the regional Amhara forces and militia reportedly took control of Humaira. They allegedly killed civilians and looted the hospital, banks, businesses, supermarkets, and private houses. She cites several other shocking incidents, the worst reportedly being the alleged mass killing of several hundred people, mainly Amharans in Maikadra on November 9th.
The High Commissioner has previously stressed that if civilians were deliberately killed by a party or parties to the conflict, these killings would amount to war crimes, and there need to be independent, impartial, thorough and transparent investigations to establish accountability and ensure justice.
Throssell says her office also has received information, as yet unverified, concerning the presence of Eritrean troops in Tigray, their involvement in the hostilities, and related serious violations of international law. The Ethiopian government has denied that Eritrean troops are involved in the conflict. Before the conflict began 7 weeks ago, some 96,000 Eritrean refugees were sheltering in four camps in Tigray. Since then, many have fled the camps in fear of safety. Earlier this month, UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi said his agency had received many disturbing reports of Eritrean refugees in Tigray being killed, abducted, and forcibly returned to Eritrea. Around the same time, the United States said it believed Eritrean troops were active in Ethiopia and called for them to be withdrawn. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new report says the number of journalists murdered for their work doubled in 2020 as criminal gangs and militant groups sought to silence reporting with violence. At least 30 journalists were killed between January 1st and December 15th. A report by press freedom organization, the Committee to Protect Journalists, found 21 reporters were murdered while the others were killed in crossfire or while on assignment. Mexico was the deadliest country, followed closely by Syria, Afghanistan, and the Philippines. Israel will hold an election in March after Parliament failed on Tuesday to meet a deadline to pass a budget, triggering a ballot presenting new challenges for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Campaigning in Israel's fourth parliamentary election in 2 years gets underway with Netanyahu facing public anger over his handling of the coronavirus pandemic while he's engaged in a corruption trial. Some analysts say the year 2020 for the Arab world, stretching across North Africa and the Levant, was catastrophic for many countries. Regional conflicts and economic problems exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic have created a disaster from which a number of nations are finding it difficult to recover. Edward Uranian brings us that story.
Lebanon was the Arab country which underwent the most serious crisis in 2020 after an explosion at Beirut port ravaged most of the capital, killing several hundred people and hitting an economy already facing the collapse of its currency with an added disaster. 2020 was also a disaster of a year for many other Arab countries spread across North Africa and the Levant, and the situation was compounded by the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The economies of countries like Syria and Yemen, in addition to Lebanon, have nearly imploded, while a general economic crisis affects other states like Tunisia, Libya, Iraq, and Iran. Egypt appears to be the only country with a positive 3.5% growth rate, although its poverty rate also appears to be on the rise. Civil war and sectarian conflicts now affect at least four regional Arab states: Libya, Yemen, Syria, and Iraq. The conflicts in Yemen and Syria appear intractable, while conflicts in Libya and Iraq sputter intermittently as outside actors get involved in their internal crises. Multiple regional and international actors, including Turkey, Qatar, the UAE, Egypt, Russia, France, and Italy, have locked horns in Libya with efforts to arm both warring parties. Meddling by Iran in Yemen has made it more difficult to solve the conflict there, as Saudi Arabia finds itself in a military morass from which it is difficult to extract itself. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman would like to extricate his country from the military and humanitarian quagmire in Yemen, but that the Houthis are making it costly to do so.
The Saudis want to get out, but they don't know how, because resolving the Yemeni question has also to do with ending Iranian military assistance that allow Yemen to launch attacks against oil installations in Saudi Arabia. How do I withdraw when you are shelling me at the time? It would look like a big defeat for the Crown Prince.
Qatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that Libya has become a failed state since the 2011 overthrow of veteran leader Colonel Muammar al-Gaddafi. The economy is in shambles, and the country's oil and gas revenues are a major bone of contention due to domestic political quarrels. He says that Libya under Colonel Gaddafi was a welfare state with only 6 million people and major oil and gas resources. Now, he argues, Libyans have become paupers, unable to sell their oil. As in Iraq, he says, this demonstrates the failure of the traditional state. It's easy to invade the country, but it's more difficult to put it back together afterwards. Abu Diab goes on to point out that December 2020 marks the 10th anniversary of the so-called Arab Spring, which began in Tunisia in December 2010 before spreading to Egypt, Libya, Syria, and Yemen. He says the period now is a critical junction where many states like Syria, Yemen, and Libya are losing their ability to function. He says, meanwhile, Egypt's military-backed government has returned to what it was before the revolution. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Every mid-autumn festival, the Live family makes mooncakes for their extended family. But as Reuters reporter Libby Hogan explains, this year is the last time they'll do that in Hong Kong.
This is the last time the Lai family celebrated Mid-Autumn Festival in Hong Kong, making mooncakes together. Aza and Willie say they no longer recognize the city they grew up in. After the demands of millions of people marching together last year were dismissed by the city's government, and Beijing imposed a sweeping national security law in June on Hong Kong that China says will maintain public safety and bring order after last year's anti-government protests. Officials also are adamant that the rights and freedoms of citizens remain intact. A Hong Kong government spokesman said last year's, quote, violent protests and anarchy on the streets may be one of the motivations for people choosing to emigrate, along with job, schooling and business opportunities or other personal reasons. But critics say the law further erodes autonomy in the city, and it's been followed by a relentless crackdown on dissent. The Lai family say the response to the protests has brought uncertainty into their lives and pushed them to emigrate to Scotland.
Us leaving is not because of politics as such, but we're leaving because politics is now impacting our lives. We're leaving Hong Kong because it isn't ideal for our children's future.
Aza and Willy were filled with hope that the city would turn towards greater democracy last year as they marched with their children during the 2 million strong June rally. But authorities dug in their heels. Police have arrested roughly 10,000 people in relation to the demonstrations.
If the youth have to worry and have to fear to speak out, then this isn't a suitable place. The best I can do right now is bring them to a more suitable environment. What's incredibly sad about this is I can only help my own children.
Hong Kong, a former British colony, was promised wide-ranging freedoms when it was returned to Chinese rule in 1997. Since the imposition of the new security law, authorities have removed some pro-democracy books in libraries, banned certain songs, raided a newsroom, and more. The lies are among thousands of Hong Kongers looking to escape Beijing's tightening grip. Initial indications show this may be a second wave of migration, similar to the decade leading up to the 1997 handover. They are sacrificing a comfortable life and rebuilding it in a place they've never been before.
This house is the result of our hardship. Together we've experienced highs and lows. Especially these few years with our third child, we've experienced some lows. But I hope we can continue on through the hardship of the path ahead.
After 3 days of packing and sifting through years of memories, they say their final goodbyes.
I'm quite nervous. It's not the same feeling as going on holiday. We're going to such an unfamiliar place. Who knows what will happen, what challenges we face.
It's not a farewell. Just see you soon.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful Wednesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Acting Defense Secretary Christopher Miller announced November 17th the United States' intention to draw down U.S. troops in both Afghanistan and Iraq. By January 15th, 2021, there will be 2,500 U.S. troops in each country. This is consistent with our established plans and strategic objectives, supported by the American people, and does not equate to a change in U.S. policy or objectives, stated Acting Defense Secretary Miller. He added, "We owe this moment to the many patriots who made the ultimate sacrifice and to their comrades who carried forward their legacy."
Together, we have mourned the loss of more than 6,900 American troops who gave their lives in Afghanistan and Iraq. And we will never forget the more than 52,000 who bear the wounds of war and all those who still carry its scars, visible and invisible.
In a call with Acting Secretary of Defense Miller, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani expressed his gratitude to every American service member who fought for peace in Afghanistan. The U.S. continues to support Afghanistan peace negotiations between the Islamic Republic and the Taliban, which present the best opportunity to reach a negotiated political settlement to end the war. Acting Defense Secretary Miller noted the United States' continued readiness to protect Americans and support American partners.
The United States Armed Forces remain committed to protecting the safety and security of the American people and supporting our like-minded allies and partners worldwide. If the forces of terror, instability, division, and hate begin a deliberate campaign to disrupt our efforts, We stand ready to apply the capabilities required to thwart them.
By bringing American troops home, we will finish this generational war, declared Acting Defense Secretary Miller. We will protect our children from the heavy burden and toll of perpetual war, and we will honor the sacrifices made in service to peace and stability in Afghanistan, Iraq, and around the world, and celebrate all those who helped us secure freedom over oppression.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.